We made numerous references to this moment throughout the morning, throughout the afternoon. But what we're going to meditate right now is the fall and the sin of Adam. Really, it's the sin of Adam and Eve. And again, going back to the original ideas, the fact that when God made us in his image and likeness, he made us as a pair. So humanity is not complete if we just look at one person. We have to kind of look at the community in a certain sense for the fullness of this image and likeness of God to be manifested. We're going to put a particular accent on Adam because he's the dude and so are you. Therefore, you know, it's easy to blame the woman and say it's all her fault. Women cause so many problems. Why? he would have been so good. He would have made a great angel. He would have been great solo, but then Eve came and pulled him down, right? You know, and when you read John Milton, Paradise Lost, classic work, I do not claim to have read much of it. I frankly just, for preaching purposes a few years ago, decided to read this section and kind of see how it went. Now, Milton was a good theologian, not perfect, but good theologian, a brilliant writer, you know, brilliant at English, a good storyteller, all that. The only one thing I have against him is it takes him like 10 pages to say what needs to be said. So I didn't print any of Milton for you because, you know, being poetic verse and repeating itself over, he's worse than me. So anyway, we poets, you know. But the gist of the story was this. So God created Adam and Eve. You know, Satan was watching this and he was jealous and he was watching from the sidelines. God created Adam and Eve, but he had sent, I don't remember, I think it was Gabriel, probably, one of the archangels, to earth to coach them. And he let them know ahead of time, hey, look, you haven't seen him yet, but there's this Satan guy out there, and watch out, because he's more powerful than you are, and therefore you need to be on your guard, and you always need to stay together, okay? That was one of the fundamental indications. Alone, you won't be able to deal with them. You have to be together. So that corresponds to the fact that Adam, when he received that first indication to protect and cultivate, you know, in the book of Genesis, it doesn't say to protect from what? There's the indirect implication that there's a threat, but we have no clue. I mean, so far, everything looked, it was groovier than Woodstock. I mean, it was like, it was a total love fest going on. Up until chapter 3 of Genesis. I mean, they didn't need mushrooms, they didn't need anything. They were just, they were doing great. So in Milton, the angel tells them, be on your guard, you have to protect the garden, and you have to do it together. And also they have that job to cultivate and to till. So Eve and Adam, they're perfect, you know, they with all the good intention in the world, but they're realizing this garden is way too big for us to cultivate the way things are going. And so Eve kind of drops the hint to Adam, wouldn't it be a nice idea if we separate a little bit so that we can get more done? And Adam lovingly tells his wife, don't you remember what the angel told us? And but Eve gradually, and again, there's seemingly with no ill intention in Milton. It's not like she was trying to pull him down. But her thought was this, look, you know, maybe if we can just do it for short periods, so we'll branch off and do our own thing for a little bit so we can get more done, and then we'll make sure that we get together several times a day so that we can build each other back up. And furthermore, won't our love become, you know, what's the expression? When a person is missing, that it makes the heart grow fonder. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, all that, right? That was my poetic trait coming out again. Missing person, fond heart. No, that didn't work. absence makes the heart grow stronger. So that was kind of her argument with Adam. And he's like, well, okay, I guess, as long as we just don't, we make sure this isn't for too long, we just really make sure we check in regularly. So, you know, already she's setting him up for a failure, right? So lo and behold, Eve is out there in the garden, looking at the tree, and she knows she has no desire whatsoever to, you know, touch the forbidden tree or do any of that stuff. And up comes the serpent. Now, the serpent in this story is not big and spooky or anything. Now, interestingly enough, Milton was not a Hebrew scholar. If he were, he would know that the word for serpent was Nahash, which apparently was the same word that used in the Old Testament for Leviathan, like giant, you know, basically Godzilla. Okay. It's what Leviathan was. It's like, say, it's this giant sea lizard thing coming out. It's like with steel teeth and, you know, picks up boats. And so that's not a cute little serpent, you know, the garter snake or something. Nahash was something formidable. I suspect in the book of Revelation, it was written in Greek, but I suspect if it was written in Hebrew, the seven-headed dragon would have been Nahash. So be that as it may. Milton says, look, because in Genesis, it says the serpent was the most cunning or the most subtle of all of the creatures that God created. Now, this is where Hebrew again seems to, like, how does this possibly work? So somehow the word subtle also means intimidating, apparently. Now, Jeff Cavins, my grid teacher, you know, I listened to those tapes or recordings so long ago, but they stuck. He gives this for an example. If you're like a 12-year-old kid and, you know, you're just minding your own business at the 7-Eleven, and you see, you know, like this big black Cadillac Eldorado with tinted windows pull up to you, and a couple of huge dudes with sunglasses, you know, and Italian features. Say, you need protection? And the kid's like, no, I'm doing okay. I don't. Well, you might need some protection. Well, why would I need protection? Well, I heard that people, you know, kids on bicycles in these parts, if they don't have protection, I heard that bad things can happen to them. And the kid's like, well, maybe I am starting to think I need some protection. So what's that imply? That was kind of the way Jeff Cavins painted the temptation of the serpent. Subtle, kind of indirect, but also intimidating. Okay. Anyway, Milton has a totally different take on it, and you can take either one, because really we weren't there. That's part of the beauty of sacred scripture, that does give you a lot of leeway. You can interpret it one way and draw out certain lessons, and you can interpret it a different way and draw out different lessons. In the Miltonian one, the serpent is attractive. You can imagine, if you don't think snakes are poisonous and they're going to bite you, there are some serpents that could be attractive. And this one, you know, had like these bejeweled kind of glittering eyes, and he put on his most spectacular looking, charming look for a serpent. And Eve is completely innocent. She's never heard of a mean animal before. They were all nice because Adam and Eve had dominion. And up comes the serpent and starts talking to her. And she's like, whoa, it's a talking snake. I've never seen any. Well, this is new. How could this possibly be? Because they've never experienced anything aside from each other that speaks. They know angels and they know God. They've never experienced another animal, material being that speaks. So she's like, oh, this is fascinating. How in the world do you speak? And the snake was like, well, I didn't used to speak. But, you know, I was going through the garden and I smelled the fruit on that tree and it smelled really good. So I took a bite and it just, like, it transformed me. It was like revolutionary. And it's like totally elevated me to another level. And Eve's like, well, you're talking about that tree. I'm not allowed to touch that tree. And the snake is, and he starts like, I can't say what God said to you. All I can say is this is what it did for me. But imagine if a lowly snake, you know, I was nothing. And if I'm able to converse with you like this, could you imagine what you would become from the starting point that you would become like gods? And, you know, maybe that's what God wants for you in the first place, because you're already made in his image and likeness. So maybe he was just telling you not to until the right time, but maybe the time has come. Maybe this is the moment for you to become like gods. And, you know, tricks her. You know the rest of the story. She falls. Now, what happens when she falls and takes the fruit? Immediately she recognizes bad idea. She feels, and the snake totally disappears at that point. She's like, see ya, gotta go. She falls, And immediately she feels within herself, because we said how everything in Adam and Eve was so perfectly harmonious, the spirit perfectly controlled the body, and all the emotions and bodily functions were in perfect equilibrium. I even said it earlier on, the preternatural gifts. Adam and Eve had gifts, you know, that we don't even know. The capacity to see the spiritual world and converse with it, for example. Perhaps the capacity to deal with physical nature and manipulate, you know, like, who knows, maybe like the Force. You know, they would have had certain things, we just don't know what they are, but they had preternatural gifts, both kind of in the spiritual realm and in the material realm that we're not even totally sure of. All of that gone. She eats the fruit and all of a sudden she just, you know what it's like when you've committed a big sin and you just feel guilt. And it's just like, everything is horrible. It's like, I was doing so good when I woke up and all of a sudden I did that stupid thing. You get in a fight with somebody, like you get in a fight with your friend or your spouse or somebody, or you just, or you snap at somebody at the office and you just feel, oh, why did I do that? And you're carrying that thing around. And so she felt that, and it wasn't just the way you and I feel it. She felt it like to an extent that nobody's ever felt it before. I mean, like all the way to the depths, because she was the higher you are, the taller you are, the bigger the fall, whatever it is, the higher you are, the bigger the fall. Well, imagine where she was and what the fall was. So she feels ugly and she feels totally non-desirable. And she feels, you know, just guilt. She just feels like she's covered with filth. Now, in that state, she's thinking, Adam, who, and she loved Adam with all of her heart up until that point. Adam is no longer going to love me. So she gets him in on it. Because if he's on the same level, then he won't abandon her. But it's kind of an interesting thing because there's no one to abandon her for. I mean, what, the local water buffalo? I don't know, but she wasn't thinking too far ahead. She was, you know, women are emotional. She was acting out of emotion at that stage. maybe she thought God was going to create a new Eve. Well, Eve 1.0 didn't work too well, so let's try again. 2.0, apple proof. Yeah, she was not an Apple product. She was Mac, or she was a PC, right? The snake was the Apple merchant. So she convinces Adam, and I don't remember how she convinced him, honestly, because he was like, "Well, I'm not supposed to eat that tree," and well, she's like, "It didn't do anything to me. I'm still here. Clearly, we misunderstood God. We didn't die." And of course he eats it, and then immediately the two of them are fighting and bickering, and you know, and then God comes and we know the story. Now, there are some, it's a literary version, right? There are some things in there that are incorrect. And one of them is this, aside from Nahash, you know, one of them is this. And again, you can't blame Milton because apparently you need to know Hebrew to know this. I don't know Hebrew, but smart people do, so I heard from them. One of them is Adam was there the whole time. He was not off in some distant corner. The way it's written apparently in the Hebrew, Eve was the first one to fall. She dragged Adam down, but he, who had the mission to be the protector and the ruler, kind of the vicar of God in the physical universe, watched it happen and didn't do a thing. And this goes back to the old Nahash being kind of, you know, the Leviathan, Godzilla form. Now, maybe he wasn't huge and monstrous, and but he was intimidating one way or another. If Satan, the most glorious spiritual being ever made, short of the Blessed Mother, who came later, if Adam and Eve have preternatural gifts to be able to see the spiritual world, which they did, and they come face to face with the most powerful creature that God has ever created, which they did, and Adam realizes, I'm no match for this, then he had a real choice. Do I defend Eve and we both die? Or do we take matters into our own hands, protect our skins, and whatever the consequences are, we'll suffer them? Negative consequences seem like they're preferable to annihilation. Now, they would have also had, because of their perfected form, probably there was an inkling that, well, if God is going to ask me, if God is faithful, and nonetheless he's going to allow me to be in a position where I could face death, then perhaps there's going to be a resurrection. Perhaps death will not have the final word. They could have, being the perfect human beings in the state of grace that they were, they probably could have arrived to that point, but they didn't. And part of it is, I think, they took, like Peter, when he walked on water and then started noticing the wind, Lord, help me, which is the right answer, by the way. When you mess up, Lord, help me is the proper choice of words. They probably did something very similar to St. Peter. They see something way beyond themselves. And they have a choice. Do I focus on the serpent who will wipe us off, leave us like little grease stains on the rock? Or do I focus on the Creator? Had they kept their eyes fixed on God, the Creator, and said, Lord, I don't get it, I don't know how this is going to work, but I trust in you. And if even if it means that I will have to die, then I trust in you. Had they done that, they would have passed the test. And every temptation, one of the first aspect of every temptation is always that the temptation looks attractive. It glitters like the apple. And or it scares like the serpent. And we take our eyes off of the Creator, off of God. And it comes down to us and the object of our attraction. So, I don't know. Let's take, for example, the sin of lust. Okay. If you get a thought or, somebody immodestly dressed. I know nobody in the Northeast dresses immodestly, but just pretend that there could be, especially in the summer. Somebody immodestly dressed walks by and, flaunting or something on the TV or computer screen or whatever the occasion, or it could just be your imagination, whatever. You have a choice, okay? There's a temptation there. Fair enough. Temptation just simply means that there's something that presents itself to you under the form of a good. It's obviously never going to present itself under the form of something bad for you. Hey, here's some rat poison. Want some? No. It's like, no, thank you. It doesn't even taste good. Nothing. It's like, it always has to present itself under the form of something good. And there is always something good to it. Nothing, even Satan is not pure evil. He's pure moral evil, but he's got plenty of good qualities. He's got a strong will. He's very smart. He's relentless. He's got all kinds of things that I wish I had. The only thing that he lacks is absolutely abysmally lacking in theological charity. Aside from that, great guy. Well, got a lot going for him. So the temptation is always going to present itself under the form of a good, and of course it's going to be attractive. Good things, by their definition, are going to attract us. Temptation, by definition, will be attractive. That's what temptation is. It is something that isn't good, that is nonetheless attractive. You're not tempted to receive the Eucharist, for example, presuming you're under ordinary conditions. You're not tempted to, you can be drawn because you love God and you desire union with Him, but He doesn't tempt you to, I'm tempted to go to heaven. Of course you are. I mean, everyone wants, that's not a temptation. That's just you doing what you were made for, right? And hopefully we can all pull it off with God's grace. So this is the first thing that happens in this temptation. We know that Satan begins with a lie and an exaggeration. The wording is, did God say you shall not eat of any tree of the garden? Which he never said. He said you can eat of any tree you want, except for one. A big difference between, You're not allowed to do anything, or you can do whatever you want except for one thing. There's an abysmal difference between those. And evil will generally present itself under those terms. Here's an irony for you. God made Adam and Eve radically free. Absolutely, perfectly free. I mean, freedom understood as, and this is a definition John Paul II said in, what was the name of the encyclical? Not Fides et Ratio, the other one. Anyway, the one on the moral theology one. I can't think of the name right now. But John Paul II defined as freedom as not the capacity to do whatever you want. It is the capacity to do what is right. Properly understood, that is freedom. Again, freedom in the absolute sense, yeah, could I stick a knife in my body? Sure, I'm free, but does that really make you freer? Does it make you freer to do stupid things that enslave you and bond, you know, lead to bondage? No. In the moment, yeah, you're free to do the stupid thing. I could take drugs. The fruits of taking drugs, especially on a regular basis, will be enslavement. It will not be increased freedom. So true freedom is the capacity to do the things that we are supposed to be doing, the good things, without being chained down by all the bad stuff. Satan here presents it, he twists it. He says, if you disobey, you will be free. You will be like gods. And here's the irony. They already were free. They already were like gods. They were in his image and likeness. And the minute they disobeyed, they lost a significant percentage of their freedom, and they were no longer in the likeness of God. They were still in his image because they had intellect and will, although even that took a nasty blow. Their intellect and will were nowhere near what they were before. They were severely crippled. The likeness of God, which likeness basically comes down to being in the state of grace, the likeness with God was gone. It was gone. Likeness is the glory of kind of God irradiating out of you, so to speak. When you're in the state of grace and things are clicking, and to the extent that you're in the state of grace, you know, the full likeness of God would be like the Blessed Virgin Mary, right? When you're in the state of grace, you have the likeness of God. When you lose the state of grace, you lose the likeness of God. We never, as long as we live and breathe, lose the image of God, because that's basically, this means you're a spiritual being with an intellect and a will, as damaged as it may be. It means you're, again, going back to the Latin capax Dei, capable of relationship with God. Okay, when each one of us sins, again, the same process, we don't tell ourselves consciously, but subconsciously there's that thing that's saying, I want to be free to do whatever I want. And you do something suicidal that makes you less free. Every time you sin, you're less free. Christ himself said, whoever commits sin is a slave to sin. It's true. Sin always enslaves. Actually, if you want a really good analysis of evil, watch the movie Nefarious. Hey, you're allowed to raise your hands. Everyone here watched Nefarious? Really well done. It's not just your typical, you know, exorcism horror movie. It was done in consultation with priests. It was done, you know, it's a theological work. And the guys that were making the movie were getting all kinds of spiritual, you know, attacks and oppression while they were making it, because the devil didn't want this out there. It really, and I've spoken to priests who are exorcists, and they say, yeah, that nailed it. The analysis of evil. It's really just pretty much a couple of conversations between two people, one who's possessed and one who's an atheist psychologist who doesn't really believe. And it's just, it creates a platform for the devil to be able to kind of reveal, this is how I operate. It well done, well acted, well directed, everything worth the watch. You know, it's not cheery, certainly. I might not watch it at 10 o'clock in the evening and then expect a nice night of sleep, but it is good for the spiritual life, so I do recommend it very well.
What was the name of it?
Nefarious. I think it's on Netflix. I don't remember if it was Amazon or Netflix, but what it is. And that's one of the things that Nefarious points out so well. This poor guy that started allowing the devil more and more leeway, and they just have completely enslaved him. And he's just the most miserable form of servitude and slavery imaginable. This guy is possessed. That's the devil's game plan. Every sin will lead you more down that path. Interesting. The tree of good and evil. What is the tree of good and evil? It is a rhetorical question. Gary's getting ready. Oh. It's like whenever I give homilies to third graders and stuff, it's like, so what do you think Jesus? Oh, I know. Relax. It's a rhetorical question. Tree of good and evil pretty much comes down to first of all, we're not 100% sure, but it seems likely that it comes down to this. What it is not, first of all, what it is not is knowledge of, like, I know what is good and I know what is evil. They already knew that. In fact, they knew it much better than you and I know it now, because they have perfect intellects, you know, total harmony, total state of grace. Here's a fallacy for you. The fallacy is that evil people understand evil better than holy people. Wrong. Absolute wrong. The holier you are, the more you understand how horrible sin is. Because, realistically, sin is just the negation of the good that is supposed to be there, the moral good that is supposed to be there. The more that you know and love God, the source of all good, the more that it becomes very obvious to you anything that is opposed to it. Okay? So the knowledge of good and evil, from that perspective, they had it, and they had it in spades. In Hebrew, again, I keep sounding like I actually know something about these languages. I don't. I flunked out, like, in the Legion, like, Greek. I don't remember anything about my Greek. A little bit of Latin. In Hebrew, I never studied, so it's not like I... But I do know this. In Hebrew, for example, because it shows up in the English, too, there's knowledge and then there's knowledge. Actually, in Spanish, there's a difference between saber y conocer in Spanish, right? Saber is I know 2 + 2 = 4, rational knowledge. Conocer is yo te conozco, I know you, Bob, I know you, Gary, I know you, Mark. It's experiential knowledge, which is different than understanding that, you know, theory of relativity, right? It's a different kind of a knowledge. English in that regard is a little bit poor. Spanish is, and most of the Romance languages, I think, pretty much have the same thing. Italian certainly does. I'm sure the others do. English is a little deficient in that regard. And Hebrew, I think, was like English in the sense that, okay, Adam knew Eve and children came forth. Well, clearly that's a different kind of knowledge than knowing what her name is, right? And there are multiple examples of that in the Bible. Somebody knows something or someone and some consequence that has nothing to do with the fact that, hey, I know who you are. No, he knew her in a completely different way that involves begetting children. Okay, to know good and evil in this context means that you get to decide what is good and what is evil. That was the temptation. And that, by the way, was Satan's fall, okay? Satan, I will not serve. Here's another interesting little factoid for you. This is unrelated, but kind of cool. Satan would not serve. He wanted to be the one to be able to decide for himself. He wanted to be like God without the inconvenience of having God be like God. So here are some things that you only get when you listen to talks by exorcists. Number one, what made Satan fall? Well, we know it's pride, fine. And probably multiple factors. Historically, one that you hear a lot is, and probably a lot of truth to it, is that God revealed to him that he was going to become incarnate and take the form of a human being, and that he would point out Christ and tell Satan, worship. And, you know, here's this lesser being of clay, and God tells Satan, worship. However, there's actually, and I think that was probably a big part of it. However, there's something else that I never had an inclination or knowledge of until within the last year when I was listening to Father Ripperger, my favorite exorcist to listen to. He was very entertaining. Do you guys know Father Ripperger? He's an exorcist. Go to YouTube. Just Chad Ripperger, Ripperger, super brain. Everything is Thomas Aquinas with him, but he's also a very good exorcist, has great materials. Well, Ripperger was interviewing the devil in his exorcism, and he once asked him, "Why do you fear and hate the Blessed Mother so much?" And any number of exorcists have said, in a sense, Satan fears Mary more than he fears God. Why would he fear that? Because it's humiliating. Imagine this, if I were to get into a cage match with whoever the reigning mixed martial, what's the MMA?
MMA.
Yeah, it is MMA. Whoever the reigning guy is, the only question would be, do I last 3 seconds or four? Maybe I could run around the ring long enough to last, 7 or 8, but it wouldn't be pretty. And it wouldn't necessarily be embarrassing because I'm a slob. I don't know anything about fighting. I'm out of shape or, whatever. So now, if I went into that same ring with like a 4-year-old girl, and she starts body slamming me and stuff. It's like I would never show my face in public. Okay, that is the difference between Satan getting whooped by God or getting whooped by Mary. Okay? It's like, you gotta be kidding me. This? Kind of like Bam Bam. It's like, yeah, you remember Bam Bam from the Flintstones, right? So imagine that. Bam Bam starts whipping you. Okay. But the thing that Satan couldn't stand apparently was he saw Mary and he knew I will always be in second place. There's going to be somebody that I will never reach that level. And then there was something even more to it because the thing that really galled him was apparently the Blessed Virgin Mary in all of her life, imagine this, however many years she lived, never once, not even for a split second, did she really think about herself. Obviously, you have to consider yourself, I'm thirsty, whatever, but never once did she think about herself from the perspective of, what do I really think I should do right now? Or never did once did she think, I'm being treated unfairly, or any of those things. It was never about her. It was always God and God's will. Not for a split second. And because of our human nature, with angels, it's one and done. You have one massive decision that's gut-wrenching and everything, and you make the right one, and you're set because they're pure spirit. For us, it's constant over and over and over again. So it was that continuous repetition of yeses to God. And then Father Ripperguru had no mercy. Just said, yeah, but you couldn't even do it once. She did like millions of times. What are you crying about? You didn't even pull up. Zero, yeah. So there you go. That was the thing that that really got to the devil. And there was another cool thing I was going to mention. Oh, yeah, something else cool. This is totally irrelevant to your meditation on sin, but it is a cool factoid. Satan wanted to be like God. And as a punishment, it wasn't even something he did to himself. As a punishment, God is a trinity. As a punishment, God split his personality. Satan has a tripartite personality. If you read in the Bible, there is Satan, there's Lucifer. Or sorry, there's Lucifer, there's. Is it Satan, Lucifer, and Beelzebul? A Baal. That's right. Lucifer, Beelzebul, and Baal. They all are names for Satan, but it's an imitation. He wanted to be like God, and he has this kind of split, three-part personality. And each one of those three apparently has their own kind of personality. Like in an exorcism, if it's Baal, he'll come out one way. If he's Lucifer, he'll come out the other, and whatever. And each one of them has their, even though it's the same person, it has nothing to do with your meditation. It's just interesting facts to keep you on your feet at night. So, back to the garden for the last time. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Aprons is an interesting word. I don't think I've ever read that translate aprons. Okay. Then they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of day, and the man and his wife hid themselves. The minute they turned their backs on God, they perceived him as an enemy. Look at today's society. How many people look at the church and they look at the faith and they come up with all kinds of, you know, nasty attacks and criticisms, and they, you know, the mentality, no, they hate us, they're judgmental, and you're like, I'm trying to love you, make it easy, please, I would like to love you, right? What happens when you turn your back on God? Then he becomes your enemy. And God gently calls out to him, where are you? And he says, I heard the sound of you in the garden and I was afraid. Interesting, God, I think this is where God kind of exerts his power. Because if God wants to make you answer, he will. It's like, hey, word up. What happened here? It's kind of like at your last judgment. You can't go to your last judgment and just remain just like, nope, all's good here. No, God is, you will be forced to say and to recognize exactly, this is who I am, this is what I did. There's no getting out of it. I think it was something like that. God kind of, you know, not meanly or anything, but just simply said, let's talk. So Adam and Eve reveal what happened. And immediately they go to accusation mode. It's her fault. Now, Adam was, again, this is the guy that was designed to protect and to provide. And his very first reaction is, some helpmate you gave me. It's like, he's like simultaneously blaming her and blaming God at the same time. Like, this is the best you could do? She's supposed to help? Okay. So he blames everybody but himself. Sound familiar?